ईश्वरानन्दाय व्रज जनरञ्जनाय रमनचरागनचारिणम्
Paramahamsa Paragrajikachara Sathya Sadashi Shimis Divine Grace Asi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Samaveda Bhakti Vinda Ki Jai Gaura Premananda All glorious system of devotees All glorious system of devotees All glorious system of devotees All glorious to Shri Guru and Shri Garanga Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamani Namaste Sarasavarim Gaura Vanabhacharni Nirvishesha Shunya Vadipaskita Anistani Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 10, Text 17. The chapter is The Nature of Fruitive Activity. Text 17. Tatrapi karmanam kartur asvatantram chalakshate Bhokishta dukha sukhayo Konvarto vivasham bhajet Tachapi karmanam kartur Asvatam tram chalakshate Bhokishta dukha sukhayo Om Bharto Vivisham Vijayat Tichapi Karmanam Kartur Asvatantram Chalakshite Bhoktishti Dukha Sukhayo Om Bharto Vivisham Vijayat
Vaishnavis,
Tetra, in the matter of one's ability to obtain happiness. Api, furthermore. Harmanam, a fruit of activities. Hartu, of the performer. Aspatantram, the lack of independence. Cha, also. Lakshite, is clearly seen. Boktu, of the one who is trying to enjoy. Cha, also. Dukha Sukhayo, happiness and unhappiness. Ka, what? Nu, indeed. Arta, value. Vivasham, for one who is not in control. Vajet, can be derived. Translation purport by disciples of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Although the performer of fruit of activities desires perpetual happiness, it is clearly observed that materialistic workers are often unhappy and only occasionally satisfied, thus proving that they are not independent or in control of their destiny. When a person is always under the superior control of another, how can he expect any valuable results from his own fruitive actions? Purport. Although materialistic persons reject Krishna consciousness and instead pursue temporary sense gratification, even that sense gratification is often beyond their reach. If a person could really control his destiny, why would he create problems for himself? No intelligent person would impose death, old age, or disease upon himself or his loved ones. One should recognize that these unwanted miseries are forced upon one by a higher power. Since we are all obviously under superior control, the atheistic philosophy advising one to simply perform fruitive activities and create a happy life is most imperfect. Due to the influence of time, happiness and misery are created. When a woman becomes pregnant, her husband, relatives, and friends eagerly await the birth of the child. As time passes and the child is born, everyone feels great happiness. But as the child grows into old age and eventually dies, that same passage of time is a cause of suffering. Ignorant persons vainly seek help from scientists who work feverishly and fruitlessly in their laboratories to stop death. In modern times, inventions have been created to eliminate the inconveniences of life, but the maintenance and production of such conveniences has proven to be unbearably inconvenient for hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. Only the most foolish person will propose that there is no superior controller and that one can achieve favorable results by expert performance of material activities. Ultimately, all material activities are useless because they end in annihilation. If one is driving a car but has only limited control, the situation is most dangerous and must lead inevitably to disaster. Similarly, although we are trying to direct the material body to happiness, we are not in full control of the bodily demands, and therefore there will inevitably be disaster. The state in Bhagavad Gita 9.3, Ashradhana Purusha Dirmayasya Parantapa Rakya Mam Navartante Vrityu Samsara Vartmani.
Those who are not faithful in the path of devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror foes, but return to birth and death in this material world. If one is not a devotee of Lord Krishna, the eventual result of his activities are simply mrityu samsara, repeated birth and death. Om jnana parandasya gananjana salakaya chaksun vikamina tasmai shri hrithi namaha. Vanchakalpa chudischa kripa sindhi bebacha pratitano pavani bio vaishna bebo namo namaha. Hare Krishna. So, materialists think they can control their destiny, but they cannot. Things go on by providential arrangement, and we cannot always control what is going to happen to us negatively or positively. I was just thinking of a personal example of this. By providential arrangement, I had to go to Atlanta this weekend, so I was supposed to give class yesterday on Monday, so I traded with Nagaraj for today. And by that providential arrangement, he got the very, very difficult philosophical verse, which I'm sure he handled very well, and to the pleasure of the audience, much better than I could. So anyway, I got a much more straightforward here that I think we can speak about with some comfort. So, the illusion of one's control, or sense of control, that one can be in charge of one's own happiness and distress in this world, is an illusion, and it begins with the bodily conception. One must first think that one is the body, that this is me, this is my vehicle of enjoyment in this material world. So that first covering of Maya is ahankara, the false ego, that I am the body and the mind and not the spirit soul. And therefore that leads to a delusional state of the living entity. I was thinking about, many of you are familiar with, probably read that many, many years ago, actually much before Srila Prabhupada came to America, he wrote an essay called Who is Crazy? Anyone remember that one? It was actually very interesting because Prabhupada raised this point. He was saying, you know, the materialists think these Hare Krishnas are crazy and we say they are, so who is correct? And then Prabhupada very clearly defined that. I want to read a little portion of that. Prabhupada said, when we are born from the womb of our mother, our body is very small. Now, where is that body? Where is the body we had as a boy? We may have photographs to remind us what the body was like in past years, but we cannot say where that body is gone. The body may change, yet we have a feeling that we do not change. I am the same man. We think in my childhood I looked like this or like that. Where have those years gone? They have vanished along with the body and everything that came in contact with it. But although everything is changing at every moment, we are still sticking to our bodily identification so that when we are asked what we are, we give an answer that is somehow or another related to this body. And then Prabhupada asks, is that not crazy? If a person identifies with something he is not, he is considered crazy. The conclusion is that one who identifies with a body cannot really be considered sane. So it's actually a very, very important point, a very good point, Prabhupada saying that if someone thinks they are something they are not, that is considered delusional or a lack of sanity. So we see in psychiatric wards around the country that people are there who think they are somebody they're not. People may think I'm Jesus or I'm this great personality or I have these great powers. So these people are considered psychotic. You know, even by the materialists. I once actually met a young man in Miami. We were in Miami, you remember Montrini? We were in Miami Beach, and we went out there with our family. And this young man told us that he was Krishna. He saw we were devotees, and he was very glad that his devotees were there. And we could properly appreciate and understand, here is Krishna. I was a bit skeptical. I remember Prabhupada used to always say, someone says they're Krishna, can they lift gold on here? I don't remember exactly, but something along those lines. Well, can you show us? Can you do some miracles? I said, I could, but I choose not to. So, yes, these people are generally considered psychotic. They're in great illusion or delusion. Similarly, one who thinks that he is the body, which is something that one is not, because one is the soul, is, in Prabhupada's words, crazy. So this is the state of practically everyone in this material world. So people delude themselves about their own nature, And they delude themselves about the nature of the material energy. And therefore, through the fruit of work, as been explained here, they are trying to find happiness and they're trying to make the best of life. And people try to convince themselves and others that material life is enjoyable. That really it's a pretty good place here. Think of all this, you know, these slogans and cliches that we hear, like, live one day at a time, stop and smell the roses, enjoy every moment, count your blessings. All right, it's good to be a little bit positive, not to be depressed and completely, you know, discouraged. But still, if one is thinking that if I will it, if I think it, I will be able to enjoy this material world, that is delusion. Now, interesting, delusion is a particular coping mechanism in psychology. Actually, Sigmund Freud was one of the original people who came up with the idea of ego defense mechanisms. Ego defense mechanisms are coping mechanisms. How we can deal with basically the suffering of the material world. The problems that we face in the material world. So people have to deal with this in many, many ways, and even psychologists recognize this. And then Freud said there were certain normal, what he called normal ego defense mechanisms, like projection, we blame things or attribute things to somebody else other than ourselves, or sublimation. You know, we have certain desires that may be inappropriate, so we channel them in other ways. Just like one may be very aggressive. Instead of hurting people, he plays football or some way of, you know, more constructively channeling that aggressive nature. Or repression. One simply tries to deny those things which are uncomfortable. Another one is intellectualization. We rationalize things away. Oh yes, I have to die, but everybody has to die. Death is part of life. It's all part of the big circle. It's all good. You know, I mean, it's like an intellectual rationalization of something that's actually very frightening and very disturbing to people. Well, these are what we call normal defense mechanisms. And there's also defense mechanisms which are less healthy. We might even call them psychotic ego defense mechanisms. And those are basically denial of reality or distortion or delusion. One very simple definition of psychosis is, and no, it's a person who has sort of normal neurotic tendencies, like most of us. You know, we basically see the world as it is, but our coping mechanisms may not be healthy. They may be a little dysfunctional. Maybe we really don't relate well, we don't respond well to things. But others who are more serious, have more serious problems, they actually have a distorted view of reality. They do not see things as a normal person would do. So most people are considered mentally ill. Now Prabhupada is making the point that spiritually we are all mentally ill because we are to have a distorted view of how things are. As long as I'm thinking this material world is all in all, or that I am this body, or whatever I do can, you know, change the course of things that I can control, then I'm basically, as Prabhupada's words, crazy or delusional, denying reality. So after one's identification with the body, what's the next illusion? The next illusion is what's been discussed in this verse, that one is in control. I am this body, and I can control the body and the senses, and my control or actions of the body and the senses and the mind will bring me happiness. And of course, it's stated here that materialistic workers are often unhappy and only occasionally satisfied. So there's a dilemma there. If one desires happiness and one is working towards that happiness, then why is there so much distress? Which brings us to the point of this verse and purport that there is no real material control. These things are enacted by the modes of nature. Despite one's best intentions, one cannot control the happiness and distress that one experiences. One of the examples that's given here as purport is actually very instructive about the passage of time. It's mentioned here that the passage of time causes both great anticipation of happiness, but also causes loss and anticipation of that loss. As stated here, a birth of a child is equally awaited. People waiting for the moment the child is born and they're enjoying the young child. But then fast forward 50, 60, 70 years and one experiences the passage of time as distress. So when we're young, we want to grow up. We mark those passage of time. Especially teenagers, they eagerly look forward to, when I'm 16, I'll get my driver's license. Then I'll graduate from high school. I'll graduate from college. And then I'll be on my own. And then I'll be independent. So this idea of the passage of time is considered good. I remember when I was a, I didn't really like being a child very much for some reason. And I was always looking forward to when I could be grown up and be an adult, you know, and be able to be independent and do things on my own and not be under anybody's control. And then you become an adult, and after several years, you really wish you were a child again. You appreciate what that was. So it's like we're always like the hankering and lamenting, you know, we're always wanting what's in the future, and then when the future comes, we're lamenting what we've lost and what could have been there in the beginning. And especially as we age, we see the passing of time as, you know, the future leads to, of course, old age, disease, and eventually death. So therefore, the passage of time is considered a very negative thing. While in the beginning, it was considered very positive. So we cannot control time. Time and tide, wait for no man. There's so many expressions, you know, like that. Prabhupada used to quote that one. I think it's an English expression. You know, so we can't control the passage of time, and therefore we cannot control our happiness and distress. To the degree that we can control things, so we have minute amounts of control, we have to recognize that all of this is imposed by a superior power. So nice line, this purport states, excuse me. Only the most foolish person will propose that there is no superior controller, and one can achieve favorable results by expert performance of material activities. So this is the problem, that one thinks that there is nothing to control. It is simply by my actions that I will get good or bad results. Now, of course, this was somewhat described in yesterday's verse about the philosophies, atheistic arguments of Jaimini and others, and Krishna refutes them. And of course, this probably reminds us of some of the arguments given in the Govardhan Lila, when Nanda Maharaj and the coward men were going to perform the Indra Puja. Krishna spoke against it. And it's very interesting because many of the arguments he gave were not exactly Krishna conscious. In fact, they're atheistic. So we can understand that all arguments, all intellectual understandings, everything comes from Krishna. So Krishna even provides the arguments to atheists against Krishna consciousness or against spiritual knowledge. Everything is coming from Krishna, and Krishna demonstrates that because he can expertly argue every side. So when he was speaking with the cowherd men, in that chapter, there were two basic philosophies. One was Karma Mimamsa, which Vishnu Chakravartakur says is basically atheism with a belief in reincarnation. It was similar to Buddhism, in a way. And the other philosophy that he espoused was an atheistic Sankhya, as opposed to the Sankhya philosophy that Kapiladeva teaches in the Bhagavatam. So atheistic Sankhya is a mechanistic philosophy of cause and effect, similar to material science. To see the material causes and effects of everything. And then, it's described that there, Vishnu Chakravartakura cites Sridhar Swami's commentary, there are six basic arguments he makes. Krishna says, first, karma alone is sufficient to determine one's destiny. One's conditioned nature is the supreme controller. That the modes of nature, the gurus, are the supreme controller. He goes through all these different ways, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's this. Who is really the supreme controller? Then he says the supreme lord is simply a dependent aspect of karma, and that he, if there is a supreme, is under the control of material nature and karma. And actually one's occupation is his worshipable deity. So simply one performs an occupation, everyone must be satisfied. If there is any superior control, that is all under the control of karma and the modes of nature. And the basic point of all that is that through one's activities, one can affect favorable results. Now, there is some truth to that. There are laws of karma. One does receive the effect of the laws of karma, positive or negative. There is some subsequent reaction to whatever behavior, activities, words, actions that one do in this lifetime. But the laws of nature are under superior control. And that is the point. They do not act independently. Krishna says, you know, that I am under, the material nature is working under my direction. So he states this 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So the laws of nature are under Krishna's control. And the problem is that not only do I just perform activities and I get some mechanical reaction, but that the higher authorities and ultimately Krishna God must be pleased by those activities to get the best results. Otherwise, we only have partial control. You know, we can affect a little bit some reaction next lifetime. You know, I may get some result or I may get some positive or negative result, you know, but when it's not yet the full result. The example is given here, it's a very nice example in this purport, about a car, that if you only had some control of the car, it would lead to disaster. So imagine that you're driving your car and you have full control over your accelerator, but you have no control of the brakes. So if your accelerator is working fine, but the brakes aren't working, what's going to happen? Probably you'll end up in an accident. So in the same way, we have a little bit of control, but we don't have full control, especially if we are not recognizing the supreme control of the personality of Godhead. Therefore, there will be inevitable disaster. You know, we do not know what this material world will bring. We cannot control the happiness and distress. You know, so one has to continually enjoy the suffer and so suffer the results of activities. So even if there is some favorable outcome from one's pious work, it's temporary. At the very best, if one acts in the mood of goodness, acts piously, and does all good works and gets some favorable reaction, it's temporary. And what happens when the results of that karma, the good karma, run out? One falls back again. And of course, Krishna says, Abhana, Abhama Bhuvana Lokarpavar, Punarvartanarjuna. From the highest plane of this material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery, wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So that's the point. The living entity has very, very, very small control in this material world. And he is basically destined to inevitably take birth after birth in this material world. And that's the reality. Reality is, no, Prabhupada would say, nobody wants suffering, yet it comes. Right? As stated in this verse, if we have so much control, then why are we not? Why cannot we control that we only have happiness and do not have distress? And one of the symptoms of knowledge, given in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is the perception of the evils of birth, death, disease, and old age. One who can understand this is in knowledge. This is intelligence, to understand the nature of this material world. So nobody wants distress, even devotees. Devotees aren't seeking unhappiness, we're not seeking distress, we're not seeking suffering, but we know a better way to get out of that, to avoid that. For sometimes we forget, you know, and we think that, you know, I'm suffering so much or whatever's happening to the material world. Remember one young devotee was speaking with me a few years ago, and he was very unhappy. So many things were going badly in his life. And he was convinced that everyone else was happy. All the other devotees were happy, but I'm unhappy. Well, I said many things to him. But one of the first things I said to him is, no one's really enjoying material happiness. Don't think everybody else is, you know, experiencing great happiness. No, we all have distress. We all have some suffering on the material plane, with this material body, the material mind, the relationship, whatever it may be. Everyone is experiencing both happiness and distress. And that's on the material plane. If you are seeing devotees who don't seem to be experiencing distress, if they seem to be happy, it's because they're experiencing a higher spiritual satisfaction. It's not coming from the material situation. Of course, due to karma, due to Krishna's arrangement, we do have different situations. Some people may seem to be, you know, in a better situation or worse situation, but those things are very relative and they're very temporary. And they may have to do with a very, you know, you take a tiny slice in the history of the living entity, you know, millions and millions of years, lifetime after lifetime, even as devotees, who knows how many lifetimes, even as a devotee, before we get out of this world. So you take a tiny slice of that, and you may see differences in how much a person is suffering or how much a person is enjoying, even a devotee. But it's all relative, and it's very, very temporary. So the real point is not to try to focus on the material situation, but to focus on our spiritual life and finding that real happiness and satisfaction that is there in our relationship with Krishna. So being in the material world is difficult. We're in an incompatible situation. We're not meant to be here. So it naturally doesn't always feel so good. You all remember the little skit they used to do all the time about the fish out of water. So that's what we are. We're like the fish out of water. No matter how much, whatever you gave the fish, no matter whatever facility, how much, you know, whatever they fed him, well, he was out of the water. He was dying, right? So in other words, we're out of the spiritual world, outside of the spiritual energy, not in relationship with Krishna. No matter what we're given, whatever material facility, we're not going to be happy. So we are spiritual beings trying to enjoy in this material atmosphere. And it inevitably doesn't work. And that's what we begin to understand when we understand spiritual knowledge. The transcendental knowledge that Srila Prabhupada has given us lets us know that our business is not to try to be happy here and to get out of this material condition of life. While in this material world, even here, we can experience our spiritual identity, at least to some degree. At least we are in the beginning processes. At least of understanding that we are not the body. We can understand intellectually, we're not the body, we're not the mind, we're not these senses, but that we are spirit soul. And as we take up the process of bhakti, I mean, that's the transcendental platform. The transcendental platform is Aham Brahmasmi, that I'm spiritual. But beyond that is the understanding of emotional service of bhakti. Not only am I the spirit soul, not this body, but I'm an eternal part and parcel of Krishna. I'm his eternal servant. And I have an eternal loving relationship with Krishna. That's what we need to begin to understand and to experience. And then we find that our real enjoyment is spiritual. And that is based on our relationship of service to Krishna. So sometimes it's described that there are two aspects to bhakti. There's a lot of ways to describe it, but one I think Jiva Goswami mentioned was one aspect of bhakti is, you know, the bhava platform, being completely in our relationship with Krishna, just experiencing that. But in the beginning relationship is through service. It's through the practical process of sadhana and devotional service and hearing and chanting and rendering service to Krishna that we begin to form that relationship and develop that relationship. And through doing so, then that progresses little by little, on and on through the years, to the higher platforms of experiencing relationship with Krishna on a very, very high platform. But even at that first beginning sadhana platform, we begin to experience Krishna. We experience Krishna through his holy name, through his service, through his devotees, through his prasadam, through his holy dhams, through his temple, and of course, in his beautiful form of Radhashyama Sundar, Krishna Balaram, Shishi Gornitai. You know. So, we're beginning that process of forming relationship, of developing relationship with Krishna. And the more that develops and the more that manifests, the less dependent we are on our relationship with the material energy. We're less dependent upon happiness and satisfaction that comes through the body, the senses, and the mind. So it may take a little, it takes a time, but it is our process. And we begin to develop that more and more. And so naturally, that identification with the body falls away. It's not an artificial thing, or it's not something I make a decision. Of course, it is an intellectual process, in one sense of understanding that I am the soul, not the body. But really, it's a process of realization, of understanding through the heart my connection with Krishna. My connection to Krishna, and that comes through my connection with Guru, the Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master. And when that develops, then the real happiness that is part of us, that is our nature as pure spirit soul, revives, and we experience that. And therefore, we're not dependent upon this false sense of control, this false sense of, I need to do these fruitive activities to be able to become happy. And we realize that the spiritual nature is beyond all of that. It's transcendental to this material energy and transcendental to any type of material happiness. So, that's our process, to simply serve Krishna and get out of this material world. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any questions or comments? Sig Prana Govinda, then Dharmaraj.
There's a verse in Bhagavatam in the beginning. It says, Ayu Harati Vaipunsam Udayan Astan Janaso Tashyarite Khananita Uttama Sloka Bhattaya. And Prabhupada mentioned that sloka in many lectures, that those who are engaged in Krishna consciousness, their time is not wasted. They are actually connected with eternal, and we are actually perfectly situated. So the whole explanation you gave is very sweet, that we see the how the karmic world is simply wasted. They don't have any control. But at the same time, we are very well established in that sense, by following Prabhupada and Krishna consciousness program. So it's very exciting.
Thank you very much. Yamaraj
Prabhu, you mentioned how Krishna was arguing, you know, at the Vidhi Govardhan festival. That was not quite Krishna conscious. We also find that Lord Buddha, he expanded the philosophy of Ahimsa. We also find the gopis, they were worshipping the demigods to get service to Krishna. So there are other examples. So my question is it okay for us to practice any of those things, or that only that you have to be qualified to use those psychologies per se to bring about a Krishna conscious conclusion?
Well, you know, these are Krishna's pastimes. And I don't think that we can really exactly use those examples in our own life. I mean, in other words, Krishna wanted to bring, you know, with his speaking with a cowherd, he wanted to bring about a certain result. Obviously, it was all, you know, he had a whole plan, pastime. You know, he stops the Jagya, he infuriates Indra, you know, deluge of rain, lifts Govardhan Hill, Indra, you know, the whole thing. You know, so I think that this was part of simply that pastime. Now, why Krishna might ask, then why is it so elaborately discussed? You know, the philosophy he gives. Because it's probably important for devotees to understand competing philosophies to some degree. So Krishna gives it, just like in the last verse and yesterday, doesn't, you know, it's like a competing philosophy is given. He says, well, you may believe this, or if you choose not to understand what I'm saying, but then of course, you know, Krishna goes on and he defeats those philosophies. So in other words, you know, in case there are doubts in people's minds, he clearly enunciates what these other atheistic philosophies are, and then of course he defeats them, you know, usually. So, yeah, I don't think we need to espouse any of these philosophies. Better that we learn how to defeat them. Yes, Ragatmika.
Forgive me that I picked up on the radio as I was coming, where you were saying, citing the analogy in the purport about a car and the accelerator and the brakes in control. Mm-hmm. Could you please explain that?
Well, the example that they gave in the purport was, I'll just read it again. If one is driving a car but has only limited control, the situation is most dangerous and must lead to inevitable disaster. Similarly, we're trying to direct material body to happiness, but not in full control of bodily demands. Therefore, that will inevitably be disaster. So in other words, if one thinks that one is in control, one has a little bit of control, you know, through one's activities, but if we don't understand the full picture, if we don't understand how Krishna is in control, you know, we will not be able to get out of this material world. An example is given the car. You might have some control of it, but if you don't have full control, you know, you're heading to go off the cliff or whatever.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Any further? Hare Krishna? Madhavati? I think Madhavati is. Madhavati?
We're talking about, initially about coping mechanism, that we do that. And I think, as for myself, I was thinking, you know, I use Krishna consciousness as a coping mechanism to go through life. And certainly, bhakti is beyond that. So, I guess my question is, how do I see, or how I could internalize the process of bhakti not as a coping mechanism, but something beyond that. So it's for my heart. Maybe you could give some.
That's a really interesting point. Of course, even with coping mechanisms, some other followers of Freud later put them in different categories. Not only, there's actually different categories, like psychotic, neurotic, and then finally, and then the final category is ones that were actually very positive. You know, like altruism, things like that, which are actually, in some ways, coping mechanisms that are very good, that are beneficial. So, you know, there's many, many different ways. And of course, the first thing I thought of when you mentioned that is that's something that we often hear, don't we? Religion is, you know, a coping mechanism, like when Karl Marx says it was the opiate of the masses. Sometimes people say religion is just a crutch. It's like if you don't have the strength to really face the world, you know, use religion in that way as a coping mechanism. And of course, we know that it's actually the opposite. People are using all these other coping mechanisms to avoid surrendering to Krishna, avoiding spiritual life, and avoiding understanding their true spiritual nature. So, in one sense, you know, it says that four kinds of people come to Krishna consciousness. You know, those in want of money, those in distress, what are the others?
Inquisitive.
And one looking for knowledge. So you could say, in one sense, people sometimes do come to Krishna consciousness for these other reasons. One's in distress. So if you're mentally suffering, like, what's the purpose of life? I'm so unhappy and distressed. One might take to a religious process as a means of getting out of that distressful situation. Of course, the difference is that one comes because of those reasons, perhaps, but then as one practices Krishna consciousness, that transforms. It transforms from a more materialistic consideration of coming to actually becoming spiritually situated or transcendentally situated in knowledge. You know? And that comes about through the purification of the heart. And when one takes to Krishna consciousness, the process of hearing and chanting purifies one so that even those other motivations become transformed. Where it transforms from, well, I'm just unhappy, or I want to feel good about life, or not be frightened of death, or something like that, to actual understanding. And that spiritual transformation comes about, and it's something we all experience. It's something we experience as Krishna consciousness really becomes part of ourselves and part of our heart. And, you know, that change of heart comes about. And do you have any, maybe you have some other explanation of it? I think it's a very interesting point. That was just kind of my offhand thoughts on it.
I've been thinking lately, how do people go through, like as devotees, you know, we understand Krishna is behind things.
Can you bring the microphone back? Let's just start again.
I don't have any answer to that, but I've been lately thinking, how do people go through their lives without Krishna? I mean, we have you know, so many things are happening in the community, or devotees going through their difficulties, and then I think, wow, you know, we're so happy that Krishna is in our lives, and we can, and to some extent, or, you know, a lot of extent is being intellectually, we can understand, you know, the philosophy, and it helps. So I've been thinking, how do people go through that, go through life without Krishna being in their life, or God being in their life? And so when you were making the point earlier, and I was thinking, yeah, maybe it's intellectually we're just trying to cope with this thing, and but bhakti is beyond that. So no, I don't have an answer to that, and therefore.
But in reality, because people can't get through their lives, that's why they develop all these coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, you know, belief in Krishna is not one of the coping mechanisms Sigmund Freud listed. You know, it's a totally transcendental response. You know, that's beyond that. Yeah, but it's true. How does one get through life? You know, and of course, sometimes you'll say, well, I believe in Krishna, but I still have some distress. The point is, if you didn't have Krishna in life, think of the distress we would have. You know, at least we have some answers. And it's not just an intellectual answer. I think that most devotees, I'm assuming, most devotees are actually experiencing, you know, some realization of the philosophy in their hearts. You know, and that comes, of course, that brings about the development of faith. And as our faith becomes stronger, then those questions don't arise so much. You know, it's an interesting question, but I think for most devotees, yeah, when faith develops, you know, one doesn't think too much of, is it just some delusion or coping mechanism or something to make me feel better? But this is reality. This is the reality. Spiritual life is the reality. Material life is the illusion. Right. Okay, and maybe one more point. I think that's Madame Mahaprabhu.
I have a question.
Okay. Oh, well, she has the mic, so go ahead.
Recently, I visited my mom in California. She's 90 years old. So, you know, she was telling me about her early days and stuff, and I could see there were lots of anxiety in her mind, you know, about death. So every morning I'll get up early and chant, you know, she was staying in bed, I would chant in her room. And I'd given her beads, you know, before, and she's a Hindu, so she knows about Krishna. So every day, every morning I was there for 3 weeks, every day I made it, make sure I got up there and chanted at least 16 rounds with her. And so one day she said, "Are you afraid of death?" And I thought, "Afraid? No." And she said, "Why not?" And I said, "I guess because I know where I'm going. I mean, I know the goal of life." And she said, "So you're not afraid at all? You don't think about it?" I said, "If I think about it, I think of Krishna, because the goal is hopefully to go to Krishna." And so I said, "Are you afraid?" And she said, "Very much." And she said, "Because I don't know what's going to happen, you know, I don't know what to expect." So I started telling about Krishna. I said, "The goal of life, you know, Krishna, you want to be with Krishna. He's, you know, he's very happy, he's beautiful, you want to be with him." And she said, "Yeah, I want to be with him, but I don't think I can go there." And anyhow, I was there for 3 weeks, and when I was leaving, she said, "I want to say something to you," in the car. And I said, "What is it?" She said, "I'm not afraid of death anymore." And she said it so confidently, I was like, it's, she said, "But the most important thing is I want to chant the Hare Krishna more. Every morning when you will chant," he said, "I wasn't afraid. And the more you chanted it, I became less afraid." And, you know, so when I was leaving, I called on the phone. I said, "Are you chanting, Mom?" He said, "Of course I'm chanting. I'm not afraid of death."
That's so a wonderful story, the power of the holy name.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, final Madame Mahaprabhu.
I think we've all thought about it, but I've kind of taken it from the 2:14 and 2:15 of Bhagavad Gita, where it says one has to learn to tolerate the happiness and the distress. So he deals with happiness and distress as one unit. The bodily conception of life, like she was talking about the fear, which we'll remember from, was it 11.237, fear arises from identification with the material body. So as one does devotional service is detachment from the fruitive mentality, which is the chapter, and which means the bodily conception of life becomes apparent and he sees himself separate. So then the distress is actually as a form of prayer, that tatenu kam hum, that even if he's expressing that, and then there's that nice verse that Janmashtami likes to quote as in the purport of 1.9.19, that it actually turns into an exchange with Krishna, that when you're suffering, you go into another state that, well, due to my past activities, you know, I've got this condition that's causing me to distress. And he doesn't identify with the body, but uses it as an instrument for his relationship with Krishna, and then it keeps developing. I think that's what.
Yeah, thank you very much. Nice. Okay, one final, Sankalpa.
So when we talk to the people, we meet people and we talk to them about what is the highest goal in Krishna consciousness. So often we present that it is to just please Krishna, Krishna's senses, and not to please ourselves. So the highest goal is to please Krishna, like exclusively. So then I always ask myself that there's actually also a spiritual selfishness there, because we want to also experience happiness. That's mm-hmm. why we do everything. And we don't want to experience material happiness separated from Krishna, but we want to experience a spiritual selfishness. So we want to please Krishna and also be happy, right? Mm-hmm. So how would you present the highest goal of Krishna consciousness? Because people, they become maybe slightly discouraged if it's only, we only please God, but not ourselves. So how do you present that? What's the highest goal?
Well, of course, everything
for ourselves.
Yeah, everything is based upon loving relationship. You know, and our highest goal is to be completely, purely in that loving relationship with Krishna. So a pure loving relationship means reciprocation. So as we want to more and more and more selflessly please Krishna, Krishna also wants to please his devotees. You know, and you know, and we even see that in, you know, the highest pastimes, the gopis, like, who were completely dedicated to Krishna, like no self-interest. But at the same time, they also achieve the highest happiness. You know, the highest bliss, or, you know, the highest stages of ecstasy, you know, are experienced by those who were the most surrendered. You know, so that's kind of, I think, how it works. It's not a bargaining thing, like, well, I'll do this for Krishna and then he'll make me happy. But inevitably, it happens. It's the inevitable result. So as you said, we all are motivated towards happiness. That's the nature of the spirit soul. It's ananda, it's bliss. So that's our nature. Our nature isn't to be unhappy or be distressed. That's not part of the eternal nature of the jiva. You know, so we attain that when we are completely in relationship with Krishna. That's a natural product of the revival of our loving relationship with Krishna. So, I mean, there's not really a conflict. You know, you might say it's a difference, it's just a question of degrees of purity. In other words, we may be more motivated towards our own happiness to do devotional service, but as we become more purified, we understand more and more that the real goal is to please Krishna, and then there's reciprocation, and so that actually motivates us to become more surrendered and more try to please Krishna, because it actually brings about greater happiness. At least that's my understanding. Okay? So, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Jai. I'm going to go to the next one.
Thank you.